The largest bird in North America is the California condor, but the bird is not present in much of California. It took a major effort by humans to make sure that condors could live free anywhere. But they are back, now numbering in hundreds instead of dozens, and could make a return to old homelands on the north coast of California. Plans are in the works, and a comment period is now open until June 4th on the plans to bring California condors back to the redwoods. The Yurok tribe is one of the partners in the reintroduction plan. Two guests join us. Tiana Williams-Clausen is a wildlife biologist for the tribe. Tiana, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Chris West is with us as well, Yurok senior biologist. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for letting us have this opportunity to talk about the tribe's program.
Sure. So, Chris, start us off. How long has it been since anyone saw a condor on the North Coast?
Well, there's varying reports of sightings. There's probably the more reliable ones are, you know, the early 1900s, but the last known two individuals were collected from Humboldt County, which is kind of part of the whole Pacific Northwest, around the turn of the century, around 1900.
Okay, so a very long time then.
Mm-hmm.
And what made the condor numbers drop so sharply across the country? Why did they have to be put into a captive breeding program because their numbers had gotten so low?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, I guess. We know that at the time of European arrival to the west coast of North America, there was large reductions in game animals. There was quite a bit of hunting going on along the coasts, especially for the Pacific Northwest, where it's known that the birds relied on marine mammals as resources. There was a lot of whaling and sealing industry going on for blubber and meat. And so the numbers of those food resources dropped dramatically at the time. At the same time, the livestock industry started up, and there was a concerted effort to remove predators from the landscape. So there was a lot of lacing of carcasses with strychnine and things like that, which probably also took a toll. And then the final thing, of course, we know is the issue related to lead ammunition. Europeans also brought rifles, using lead ammunition for harvesting game, and that use of that spread pretty quickly along the coast, and so there was lead-tainted carcasses and offal across the landscape.
Are the condors particularly prone to poisoning from lead more so than other birds? It seems to be a major a theme that runs through the documents about condor reintroduction.
You know, that was that's been kind of the belief for some time. However, recent research kind of indicates that they're not really a whole lot more susceptible to lead than eagles and other large soaring raptors. The current research shows that the exposure is just so frequent with condors that the likelihood of them eventually getting exposed to a toxic dose is pretty good. We're now, some of the recent research seems to indicate that it's likely that birds are being exposed to potentially lethal doses of lead maybe 10 times in a year. So just because they seek out large game, which often has been shot, sometimes carries legacy lead in them, even if a deer or elk survives, or pig, they may carry lead for a long time. And there's just a lot of it out there across the landscape in large game.
So because condor are not raptors, they will feed on stuff that's already dead, they're more prone then to pick up lead poisoning because somebody else killed the animal.
Yeah, they really hone in on large carcasses because they're such a large animal, and they really focus on those large game species.
Chris West and Tiana Williams-Clausen joining us from the Yurok tribe to talk about the tribe's role in California condor reintroduction on the North Coast. You're welcome to join our conversation. Questions about the California condor and the reintroduction process? Don't forget the comment period is open until June 4th. We'll talk about that more in just a moment. But you can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Tiana Williams-Clausen, can you talk about how intertwined the condor and its image is with the culture of the Yuroks?
Definitely. Speaking as a Yurok tribal member myself, I can say that our relationship with condor goes all the way back to the beginning of time in our histories, when the Creator was really kind of devising how the world was going to be. And at that time, he was developing one of the Yurok tribe's most sacred tasks, which was our world renewal ceremonies. And the California condor, which as a scavenger is kind of the ultimate in renewal, goes out across the landscape, takes things that are dead and beyond recovery, and brings them back to life. and opens them up actually to other scavengers as well so that they can feed, cleaning up the land. So he ties really to that world renewal ceremony that we hold every couple of years. We use his feathers and the regalia. We use a song that our stories say that he gave to us and is a very powerful prayer. And without having condors here to also carry our prayers to the skies, because he plays a lot of roles in our world renewal, we've been very negatively impacted from a cultural perspective, which is really what has been the initial drive for condor reintroductions.
More cultural, you're saying, than biological?
It's very difficult to separate the two from the tribal perspective. Of course, Yurok people, all Native peoples, really all peoples, are integrally tied to the lands that they live on. So a lot of the things that Chris West has been talking about that drove the condors out have also negatively impacted the Yurok tribe. So as we work to renew our world, both from the cultural and spiritual perspective and also from the physical perspective so that we can have a healthy home for condors, we're actually renewing our entire world, including our Yurok people and our cultural way of life.
Sort of a double take on renewal then. I mean, not just the usual role of the condor, but in renewing the importance of the tribe as well.
Indeed. I'd say so.
So how did the chance to be involved with reintroduction come about, Tiana?
Very hard work and dedication and a lot of persistence on our part, actually. We had the dream of condor reintroduction all the way back in 2003 when we had a panel of elders specifically tasked with identifying natural and cultural resources that required restoration as the Yurok tribe tried to rebuild itself after European-American colonization. And they identified condor as the single most important terrestrial-based species to be returned to Yurok ancestral territory. And so from that point, we actually started pursuing funding to begin what was necessary for habitat assessments and preparing the way to bring condor home. We actually ran across Chris West, who had worked for the condor recovery program in other capacities and was actually going to school as a master's student up here at the time at Humboldt State University. And he kind of served as a liaison between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the tribe, describing our desires and our needs and helping us kind of pave the path to what we needed to do to bring condors back.
So, Tiana, it sounds like the tribe had to raise the issue. This is not necessarily something that that the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service were considering.
No, I would definitely say this was initially a Yurok tribal endeavor. We were very lucky that when we first brought it up to the National Park Service, they were enthused about it because, of course, they want a whole and complete landscape around here as well. And so they've been the very strong partners from the beginning. But, yep, it was definitely a Yurok tribe endeavor. We did most of the research to ensure a safe harbor for condors to come home to and have really been pushing since the very beginning.
Chris, talk about that exposure to condors before. Had you worked with them before you went to Humboldt State?
I had. I was kind of a freelance wildlife field worker type after graduating with my bachelor's degree, and I got involved with condor conservation working for the Ventana Wildlife Society back in 1999. And, you know, I'd worked on a few other field projects, but I really fell in love with condors, just the urgency of it, the fact that there were so few, at least, you know, at that time. The numbers are growing, which is great, but, you know, you could really get to know the species you were working with on an individual level. And so I just really was taken with that. So I pursued condor conservation, went to graduate school to study behavior of condors post-release to look at, you know, how the rearing program was potentially affecting their behavior once they were released into the wild. And when I was wrapping up that research is when I got involved with the tribe.
Tiana, what are some of the needs of the condor that has to be addressed or have had to be addressed, I should say, up to this point, the things that you had to figure out that the condor would need to be able to live in the wild on the North Coast?
Well, I'd say three major things that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had talked to us, you know, obviously as the keeper of the endangered species, were ensuring that, for one, the habitat could support them kind of from the physical landscape. Could they find roosting and nesting and food and all that sort of thing? And so we did a large geospatial analysis of our landscape. And, of course, the North Coast just popped up beautifully with all of our large mountain ranges and river corridors and coastal areas that provide a lot of wind and provide a lot of access to all the resources for California condors. And we also worked in conjunction with our partner National Park Service, Redwood National Park, because a lot of their lands that they've been maintaining are really good condor habitat. For example, the Bald Hills Prairie area is beautiful for foraging, or the old growth redwoods are beautiful for nesting. So that was the first thing we addressed. We also did a several-year-long assessment of the potential threats from the use of lead ammunition in the area. We have a strong hunting population, which is great because they provide a very necessary ecological function in this day and age, but did have the potential impact from the use of lead ammunition. So we studied turkey vultures and common ravens as kind of avian surrogates, and kind of got the results that we sort of expected. There was not as much lead in our area as had been studied in some other areas, but there was still an impact. So at that time, we actually started our Hunters as Stewards project as well, which was just reaching out to the hunting community, including the Yurok tribal community, because we are a strong hunting community, just to kind of address that issue and say, hey, why don't you voluntarily join us as partners and switch to non-lead alternatives, which we can talk about more if you like. But the last thing was really addressing the issue of DDT exposure, because while we banned DDT decades ago now, it actually remains as a legacy contaminant in marine mammal carcasses, being a lipophilic chemical that binds to the blubber, and which long-lived animals like whales and California sea lions can kind of accumulate over time, and then if they die on our coast, can kind of leave those contaminants behind in our relatively pristine ecosystem. Turns out that doesn't look to be too much of a concern. Our levels are orders of magnitude smaller than some other areas that have been studied. But those were the three major ones, habitat assessment and those two major contaminants of concern.
So with those two major contaminants, I mean, it sounds like it wasn't particularly close. It wasn't like, well, we're kind of good enough for condors to live. It sounds like you have a pretty good clear margin.
I think Chris could probably answer that question better about the lead. The DDT looked pretty good, I'd say.
Yeah, as far as the lead goes, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with a situation where a bird can eat a single large chunk of lead and succumb to lead toxicosis and die from that, any amount of lead can be lethal. So, I mean, what we typically tell people is the reality of lead on the landscape is that you're going to lose birds. When you have birds that are sensitive to it, it's still being used, even if every legal hunter out there makes the switch, as is being mandated by California law at this point, there's going to be people poaching. There's going to be legacy lead that's carried around for 10 years in an elk, and it's going to die, and a condor is going to get exposed. So I try and prepare people and say, look, the likelihood is we're going to lose condors. That doesn't mean that the hunting community is bad. It doesn't mean that people aren't making the effort. It's just that there's so much prevalent lead out there at this time that the chances are we're going to lose some birds from it. But I do think that we're moving in the right direction. Oregon doesn't have any legislation. The tribe itself did not push for legislation at all for lead. We were really trying to engage more with the hunting community rather than legislate to them, and those have been our recommendations over time. And that's really, I think, the tack that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been taking is to really engage with the hunting community. And we've been helping wherever we can with that because we really support ODF&W's efforts in that regard. They're really working to try and engage hunters as part of the solution rather than pointing fingers and saying that, you know, they're the problem. And I think that's really the right approach. And the Oregon Zoo has really been helping them also, spearheading those efforts up in Oregon.
Okay, so a lot of entities on the Oregon side. We'll explain in a moment. We're talking about condor, California condor reintroduction on the north coast of California. Tiana Williams-Clausen is a wildlife biologist with the Yurok Tribe. Chris West is Yurok's senior biologist. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And this is where we should point out, Chris, that we're talking about Oregon entities, because even though the first settling of birds, should it come to pass, will be on the California side, they'll expand their range by themselves, won't they?
Oh, certainly. You know, we're going to be largely starting with birds reared in captivity, and so birds that are not flighted. And so when you start out a brand new population like that, it takes them a little bit of time to expand. typically when a California condor fledges out of its nest, it follows its parents around for about a year and a half before it really goes off on its own and learns the ropes. When you're starting a brand new population, there's no parents out there showing these birds what to do. So it's a little chaotic at first. The fact that they start out slow and learn the ropes slowly is fine because you don't want them to expand too quickly and get into too much trouble. But once they get flighted and get their wings under them, they will expand relatively quickly. And when you get to, a mature condor or even a juvenile bird that's several years old, they don't reach maturity until about 7 years of age. We're talking about a bird that can fly 200 miles in a day foraging. So once they get flighted well, then forays into Oregon, even if they're roosting on the Klamath River in California, would not be uncommon.
Tiana, I want to ask about one of the issues that's been ongoing on the North Coast, which is illegal marijuana grows where strong pesticides and poisons are used. I wondered if this came up in discussions of condor reintroduction and potential effects on the birds.
It has come up, and it is something that we will be watching. The Yurok Tribe, in coordination with the federal government, has actually been doing a lot of eradication in this area, particularly because we just have beautiful land for growing it, unfortunately. There's a lot of environmental impacts that go along with it, not only reduction in water, but the heavy use of rodenticides, which get into the species that a condor may feed on. And unfortunately, we can't really assess what that's going to be unless or until the birds actually come back to the landscape and we see if it ends up being an impact. We've begun discussions of how do we address this in the community, especially with legalization in California of marijuana. There's still the illegal grows, which are our most concern, but if we can somehow engage with the community that is using marijuana the most, and really explain, hey, you got to be sure about your sources, for example, then maybe we can start making a change so that these chemicals aren't impacting. But we really won't know what the impact is to birds until they're out on the landscape, and we can assess them and make sure that they're not or are being impacted.
Let us take a call here. Jeff in Medford is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk condors with Tiana Williams-Clausen and Chris West.
Very interesting conversation, and I would be thrilled to see condors flying over the skies in Oregon. And I heard the conversation already about the lead ammunition, lead bullets, and I'm a hunter, and I would just like to put in a plug for copper, all solid copper ammunition. It's I've been using it for years, and I'm a pretty successful deer hunter, and it works very well. Friends of mine in Montana have used copper ammunition to hunt elk and successfully. And there isn't any reason in the world why hunters should be resistant to changing over to copper ammunition, although I have had people get very upset at me, even dealers in some of the large box stores that sell ammunition, even for asking for lead ammunition if they had it.
Okay.
And I've had a member of the Oregon Hunters Association start yelling at me because I asked if they could promote the use of copper ammunition. So
interesting. So let's get a response from our guests here. So, Tiana, what is the usual reason for using lead? Is it just because it has impact and is more likely to bring down an animal?
You know, honestly, it's just kind of what we've been using forever, for centuries, really, since rifle ammunition became a thing. To speak honestly, copper ammunition is interesting in that we're kind of espousing it as a clean alternative, but really copper ammunition was developed to be a premium ammunition type. It wasn't developed to be a green or eco-friendly bullet. It was developed to be something that did the job. But most people use lead. That's what they've always been using, and making a transition to something when they don't really understand why, and they don't really understand how necessarily, just because it's a new thing, is sometimes difficult. People have a lot of questions. And so that's what our Hunters as Stewards project is about. That's what the Oregon Zoo and ODF&W are working towards, is to just really answer those questions that people either have or just may not have been aware of certain issues.
So, Chris West, at this point, we have an environmental assessment. There is a comment period open until June 4th. And then, I mean, how complete a plan is there? I mean, do we have ideas of numbers of birds and actual places to put them, things like that?
Yeah, I think that the primary guidelines that have been kind of steering the condo recovery program for some time are the same kinds of guidelines that we would have in place here. There are some innovations that we're trying to work on. We've got a couple of sites that we've selected that we think would work really well, and that's part of what the public comment process is going to be working on, is the environmental assessment as part of our NEPA assessment regulatory process, just to see what sites are better, do they have any negative impacts for land managers or anything like that. And as far as the reintroductions, you know, we're going to be, you know, we'll have a field flight pen that will hold birds in so that they can acclimate to the field. And then the typical range of numbers to reintroduce per year has been about 6 birds annually at the other release sites, and that's what we're going to be targeting up here. So about 6 birds a year. At this point in time, we're looking at probably about a 20-year project.
Okay, so this is not like, yay, the condors are back in 3 or 4 years. It's a long, long haul.
It is a long haul, and like the other sites, you know, many of which have been operating for 20 years already, you know, they're still working hard, they're still reintroducing birds and introducing new technologies, which, of course, we get the benefit of having all of these sites with these long histories. So, you know, we have the most updated techniques. We're going to have GPS transmitters on all the birds. We'll be able to tell where they are at all times. We really have a leg up on the management, just from the hard work that these other sites have put in.
Oh, that's true. You do have a lot of history behind you now, for sure, to help you off with the process. So what's the soonest, Chris, we might see any birds reintroduced?
Well, I don't like to be pre-decisional because we're still going through the NEPA process.
Okay.
But if everything goes well, we could get birds as early as next year. If things go slow with the NEPA process, it could take a little bit longer.
Okay, so the comment period open until June 4th. There are directions on our website at jeffexchange.org to get you to the comment area, and we will see how soon we can get condors back on the North Coast. Chris West, Yurok Senior Biologist, Tiana Williams-Clausen, Tribal Biologist for the Yurok. Thank you both for joining us today on The Exchange.